Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Kanzer, and I'm joined today by a globetrotting comics journalist. He's the author of the books Brief Histories of Everyday Objects, This Land is My Land, and Spring Rain, a graphic memoir of love, madness, and revolutions. He's also a contributing editor at The Nib, and he teaches cartooning at Stanford University and the Animation Workshop in Denmark. Andy Warner, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. Because we're staying safe and trying to get those COVID numbers down, we are not in the station to take your calls right now. But you can show your support by giving online, kboo.fm. If you support KBOO now, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $10,000. This is happening until September 20th, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or if you like, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. That's 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. So Andy, I introduced you as a globe-trotting comics artist, but you've been moving from place to place, country to country, long before you were making any of your own decisions about your career or even your schooling.
That's true. So I was born in Southern California, in Santa Barbara, but my dad is a marine biologist who studied, he's retired now, sex-changing fish. And so his research brought us really all over the world. And not only me, but, you know, generationally as well. Like, my mother also grew up in Trinidad. She grew up in Mexico, even though her family is from Connecticut. And so it was always sort of formed a part of my upbringing and my adult life, too.
Well, your book, Spring Rain, is based on your own experiences traveling to Lebanon in 2005 to study Arab literature at the American University of Beirut. At the time, Lebanon was enjoying a period of peace and stability after years of civil unrest and invasions from Syria and Israel.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a brief period. Israel had only pulled out across the southern border 5 years before, and the Lebanese state has never been strong in the wake of the civil war since the Taif Accords ended the civil war in the early 90s and kind of established the modern sectarian Lebanese state. The state's always been pretty weak, and there's always been these kind of flare-ups of unrest in the country, kind of directed towards this ruling class that has had their grip on the country basically since the end of the civil war, this kind of coalition of warlords and plutocrats and their children and nephews and stuff like that. But the time that I was there in 2005, like, a lot of people were talking about this, you know, Lebanon on the rise. Like, it had been a few years since there had been anything that had really happened there. It's always been this huge regional hub, whether it's enduring war, unrest, or peace, for journalists, for business, for education. So with 5 years of relative stability under its belt, Beirut was really seen from the outside and especially from the inside as being on the rise. And then about a month after I arrived there, it was rocked by this enormous explosion. Up until last month, the largest explosion, which assassinated the former Prime Minister, Rafik Hariri, who was on the verge of running and attempting to get power again.
Yeah, it might surprise some people to know that back in the mid-20th century, Beirut was known as the Paris of the Middle East. When the French took over control of the region from the Ottoman Empire after World War I, there was something of a renaissance in culture, architecture, tourism, finance.
Yeah, and literature. So one of the reasons that I was in Beirut in 2005, I was an undergrad, I was majoring in Near Eastern Studies, and I became really interested in Lebanese literature. You know, Lebanon and Beirut especially was always a kind of literary hub of the Middle East. You'd have Beirut, you'd have Baghdad, you'd have Cairo, were kind of the three places where you had a ton of publishers, a ton of authors, kind of in dialogue with each other. And then during the civil war in Lebanon, this group of authors that have been studied a little bit, called the Beirut Decentrists, arose that were mainly women writing about their own experiences. And it was this really cool group of artists that I became really interested in. And that was what brought me there in 2005. So I think it's really important to emphasize that even during times that are perceived as its darkest hours, you know, during the depths of the Civil War, Beirut has always still been host to an amazing cultural scene and, you know, very cosmopolitan cultural scene too. And it's famously a city where anybody crosses paths and people are coming and people are going, journalists and students, et cetera.
Well, let's have a reading right now from Spring Rain, a graphic memoir of love, madness, and revolutions.
Okay. So it starts off with kind of an overhead bird's eye shot of the peninsula that Beirut is on. This kind of rocky peninsula with a plane from Middle Eastern Airlines coming in. And I begin the book with a line, "Memory is tricky business. The things you remember often are the most vivid. Their neural paths are worn deep in your brain. They're also the most treacherous. Each time you recall a memory, it's rewritten the moment you think of it. It is that rewriting that you remember the next time. A copy of a copy of a copy. Inconsistencies creep in, creating new ways through the story or obscuring older roads." So this is my first time writing kind of a memoir. You know, I've written autobio before in short form, but writing something this big, you're kind of wrestling with the issue of consistency and memory. And that was a problem that I really went into the book wrestling with. And so starting off with that seemed to set the tone for it.
Journaling and diaries play an important role in your story, not just your own diary, but also the journals that your mom started for you when you were a kid.
Yeah, it's funny. I think because she really wanted us to kind of keep our childhood with us and recognized because of her own childhood traveling around how special it was. My mom made us keep diaries when we were kids, and she would actually write in them as the diary and ask us questions. So to a child, it appeared as if the diary was kind of writing to us and asking us what we were doing and asking us for more. And I mean, looking back on it in a certain way, it probably helped develop like storytelling skills and all these things that have helped me as an artist. And it's a practice that I've kept up inconsistently throughout my life. I'll suddenly start journaling again, and then I'll drop off from it. And I hadn't done it for a while before I started again, and when I went to Beirut. And I think something about the experience of it made me realize that it would be this important document going in. And so I kept scrupulous notes, even as my sort of self was fragmenting and everything around me was getting chaotic.
Yeah, there are some conversations you replay in the book, Spring Rain, conversations you had with your mom about your family, the mental health history, and you come back to this phrase, "it runs in families." And yeah, if somebody is going to have issues with their mental health, say bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, it's really common for the symptoms to start emerging right around the undergraduate years, the late teens, the early 20s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because of that, so my mom kind of grew up in not only in all these different places, but she also grew up with a mother who was an astonishingly talented artist. She was a sculptor and made these wonderful stone busts, one of which we have in my house that I grew up in. But she also suffered from bipolar disorder. And she was treated with electroshock therapy and also with medication. So she grew up with this as part of her life and had talked about it to us a lot as kids. And so we grew up with this idea that it was a possibility. And I think that having that hang over you in a period of crisis like that made me think about it a lot. I mean, it's something that I still think about a lot. It's an ongoing struggle in my life. And the role of family, both as a vector for something like this, but also as a support system, is something that I think about a lot.
So in the book, in Spring Rain, almost by accident, you became part of the largest public gathering in Beirut's history, at least up to that point.
Yeah, there's been bigger ones since then. But yeah, I mean, so the assassination of Rafik Hariri, this former prime minister, I mean, he was more than a prime minister. He was this incredibly rich man. He was the world's fourth richest politician when he was killed. And his company gobbled up a ton of downtown, war-torn Beirut real estate in the aftermath of the Civil War and rebuilt it as this sort of high-end luxury tourist zone catering to, you know, this like glitzy crowd. And a lot of people hate him for that. Other people love him. He was this lightning rod figure, and his assassination, at the time, the perception was that it was basically a hit that was ordered by Syria, which was the occupying, again, the Lebanese Civil War ended in the early 90s, but it kind of never really ended. Syria had marched into Beirut and even shelled Beirut at the end of the Lebanese Civil War, and was sort of the power broker that guaranteed the peace in the aftermath, and then basically kept the country as a client state. And it was pretty out in the open about it. There was like an office of Syrian army intelligence on the street of a friend of mine. There were Syrian troops in the country. And immediately in the aftermath of Hariri's assassination, people rose up and basically drove out the Syrian occupation. And it was a movement that seemed at first to be kind of something new and big, and then was immediately co-opted by entrenched sectarian interests and led to these dueling series of enormous protests and then enormous counter protests. And again, opportunistically, the political class of Lebanon kind of like retreated to their corners, and everybody then became very disheartened. And then years passed and the cycle repeated itself.
And so much of this happened during the one semester that you spent at the American University in Beirut. And there's a through line in the book, in Spring Rain, that follows the breakdown of society in Beirut and kind of the breakdown that you're having personally. And then in the end, the resilience that comes out of that.
Yeah, I mean, a resilience, but also not a resolution. And I think that that was really an important thing for me, because I think that it's false to present either personal narratives or revolutionary narratives that have endpoints, because it's always this ongoing process of, you know, if you're talking about mental health, there's no sort of blissful endpoint that you really ever reach. It's this constant negotiation with yourself and the situations that you're in and your inputs and outputs, and things get better and things get worse. And honestly, politics is kind of the same way. Like, you can decide to end something at some point and figure out that you've got a pretty good narrative out of it, but it's you know, you end up with a resilience because of having experienced traumas and having experienced cycles of, you know, if you're a place, cycles of uprising, cycles of revolution, cycles of challenging authority. But very often those end in counter-revolution or old order reasserting itself, or, you know, personally, like things coming apart again. And I think that it's trying to find a space for that in the book was as important to me as trying to also provide a hopeful narrative to it, that I do think that there is a way to view these things as being on an upswing while also living with the truth that it's never a battle that's won.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and I'm talking today with comics journalist Andy Warner. He's the author of the books Brief Histories of Everyday Objects, This Land is My Land, and Spring Rain, a graphic memoir of love, madness, and revolutions. And while everybody's enjoying this conversation today, I do want to remind our listeners that you can help keep this community media outlet strong. Donate today at kboo.fm/give. We are being cautious during this pandemic, so we're not in the station to take your calls right now, but you can show your support by giving online, kboo.fm. And if you support KBOO now, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $10,000. This is happening until September 20th, thanks to the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or if you like, you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. So, Andy, you've worked on various projects for some interesting clients. Right up there on the list of clients are some agencies at the United Nations.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a ton of freelance work over my career, most of it focusing in some way around the idea of nonfiction comics. That's sort of what I do for a living, whether it's memoir or journalism or history. And in some cases, I do advocacy work too. So I worked with UNESCO and UNRWA to do these series that were trying to bring light to the refugee crisis, kind of flowing out of the Syrian civil war. I had done previous reporting work on that for Slate, for the NIB, for a few outlets, and they were trying to do this awareness-raising campaign, and comics do really well online, so they commissioned me to do a comics journalist take on the refugee crisis for them.
And also some international diplomacy for other areas of the Middle East.
Yeah, it's funny. I was like an agent of weird American soft power under the Obama administration a couple times. I got sent out to Bahrain, like the State Department brought me out there as like a guest for a comics conference. There was like a big weird cutout of Barack Obama, and I like talked to people about comics and like American indie comics and weird stuff like that. And then I also was brought out again by like the State Department as a co-sponsor to Cairo Comics. Cairo Comics 2 was the second iteration of this really awesome comics convention that this Egyptian comic collective called Tok Tok was putting on. And that was, I mean, an amazing experience. But it was also, I mean, it's interesting to be the smiley face on the empire, you know, because there's like a real history of the CIA like bankrolling literary publications and all sorts of under the table weird stuff. And, you know, I like don't hide my politics. So I just took the tickets and made the connection to Arab cartoonists that I met in Cairo, and then proceeded to hire them for projects at the NIB. And it was a weird experience, especially the people that you deal with at the State Department, because they kind of reminded me a little bit of myself if I believed in American exceptionalism. but they all quit after, you know, Trump got into office. And I assume all those programs are long gone, because who's trying to be friendly to the Arab world using random American cartoonists anymore?
So did anybody from the CIA give you a friendly phone call before you left Berkeley for Bahrain?
No. I mean, it's a weird thing. Like I remember at one point friends like in Beirut, you know, took my wife aside, who works for, I don't need to get into her job, but it's not for the CIA. But they were like, do you work for the CIA? Like, you can tell us, like, you're just here all the time. Like, you speak French, like, you can just tell us. So, I mean, those people are there. America is everywhere. Like, you're not gonna kind of escape the fact that you're an agent of the empire. So you might as well take the free plane ticket. But Bahrain was pretty great. My handler there was a super nice guy. He was like a big comics fan. And his wife is the first female film director from Saudi Arabia, I think. She like won this award for this fantastic movie about this girl on this bicycle. And we like went to dinner at her house, and, you know, he like drove me around, but he was like, you can't talk about the protests to the people. Like, they'll get arrested. It's not like you, like there's a security state here and they'll get like hauled off. So you shouldn't do that. And I was like, that's fair. I don't want to like endanger anybody. Yeah, I mean, it was weird.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your teaching. You've been working at two places as an instructor, Stanford University and the animation workshop in Denmark. It's got to be very different teaching at Stanford and teaching in Denmark.
Yeah, well, they're very different models. The animation workshop in Denmark is this really fascinating system where it's almost all guest teachers, basically. There's like a program runner per class. There's no real faculty. It's just these often professionals in the field, but sometimes teachers at other institutions that they bring out. So my course there is just a 2-week course every other year, and they like bring me out and I like stay there for 2 weeks and then teach it and then go home. It's a great program. The animation workshop used to only teach animation. And then I think, gosh, it must be maybe 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago, they started this comics program, and it's just fantastic. I mean, the students they're putting out are incredibly talented. And so that's that system. And then the Stanford program is a totally different class structure. It's all the students get together, and it's over the course of 2 quarters. They all in this group put together this nonfiction comic. So they're all working together to write it, to draw it, to research it. And they actually put out a book each time it happens. Some of which, the last one that we just did, Flying Kites, was nominated for the Slate Cartoonist Studio Prize. So, I mean, these students like produce amazing kick-ass stuff. And yeah, it's a real honor to like help in any way that I can, really. And it's really fun to teach too. I mean, honestly, I find it very interesting because it makes me think about what I do and why I do it and the choices that I make. And also having to explain yourself to other people gives you a kind of deeper feeling for your craft and what you're doing.
Well, you've created a couple of more lighthearted books, comics journalism pieces. One of them is called Brief Histories of Everyday Objects. And the other one is This Land is My Land, a graphic history of big dreams, micronations, and other self-made states. You wrote that one with Sophie Louise Dam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sophie actually was a former student of mine at the animation workshop. So that's another, you know, nice thing about teaching is sometimes you meet incredibly talented people who you end up collaborating on something with. But yeah, you know, those are more examples of history. Again, it's all nonfiction for me, so it's all kind of the same like
stuff you're interested in
that I'm using. Yeah, exactly. I really love finding stories and cataloging them and finding ways to create themes and organize them. That's always been a hallmark of my career. And both those books are sort of in that vein of finding almost an organizational tool. In the case of Brief Histories, it was really short histories of the most boring things I could think of, like toilets and toothbrushes and beer cans and stuff like that.
And along the way, you're showing that there were disruptions and riots and things that formed these.
So it's like using a lens almost. So like take that idea, and then I use that idea to like tell human history and tell stories about people and stories about things and the way that people cheat each other and copy each other and help each other and lift each other up, and how people are bad to each other because of race or gender or sexuality or whatever, or good to each other. Like, you can find a way to tell human stories using these organizational tools. And that's what underpins that book. It's also what underpins the Utopias book, because I was really thinking about utopias and radical reimaginings of society and things like that. This is all before the pandemic, ironically. But that governed that. And then actually my current project is called Commonplace Creatures. And again, it's another one of these books. This one is about domestication and animals and humans and, you know, dogs and horses and mosquitoes and things. I love to do that. I love to find a way to organize information and then start creating human stories out of that.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Counser, and my guest today has been Andy Warner, author of the books Brief Histories of Everyday Objects, This Land is My Land, and Spring Rain, a graphic memoir of love, madness, and revolutions. Andy, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, too.
For our listeners who might be interested in your various projects, how can they find out more?
You can go to my website, andywarnercomics.com. I am on Twitter at andycomics, but I don't really tweet much at all ever. Sorry to everybody who wants me to tweet like my publicists. But also, I mean, my books are available in stores. And I would very much encourage you to buy them from your local independent comic book store or bookstore, rather than our evil overlords. But, you know, do whatever you got to do.
Well, thanks again. And thanks also to our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. Plus, a very special thanks to Ken Jones for his expert work engineering today's program. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.FM/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture. Shop, 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 shop